Okay, so the first panel is going to be on low resource languages and artificial intelligence, and it will be moderated by myself. It's Monday, my English needs to work. So our first speaker is Nomonde Kalo, if you can join me on the stage. She is a PhD student at the University of Cape Town and research fellow at the Hasso-Plattner Institute. Her research work in areas of interest are natural language processing and clinical natural language processing. She holds a master's and undergraduate degrees in computer science from the University of the Witwatersrand. Her PhD research integrates artificial intelligence techniques with linguistic principles to develop algorithms that can effectively simplify and personalize medical texts according to lay readers' comprehension level, without losing critical medical information. Her passion for bridging the communication gap in healthcare drives her continuous efforts to enhance patients' comprehension. She has worked as a research intern at IBM and a game developer lecturer at the Vega Institute. Prior to her research career, she also held data analysis roles at Nedbank and Momentum Limited. Outside of her research, she tutors STEM topics as part of a community development initiatives and serves on the board of Help the Matriculant, an organization that provides career guidance to underprivileged learners in Limpopo. One other thing that she did not put on the bio is she's on the organizing committee of the Deep Learning Endeavor South Africa. So please help me in welcoming Nomonde Kalo. Our next speaker is Professor Vukosi Marivate, who is an Associate Professor of Computer Science and holds the APSA UP Chair of Data Science at the University of Pretoria. He specializes in developing machine learning and artificial intelligence methods to extract insights from data, with a particular focus on the intersection of ML and AI and natural language processing. His research is dedicated to improving the methods, tools, and availability of data for local or low-resource languages. As the leader of the Data Science for Social Impact Research Group in the Computer Science Department, Professor Vukosi Marivate is interested in using data science to solve social challenges. He has worked on projects related to science, energy, public safety, and utilities, amongst others. He is the co-founder and CTO of the Lalaba AI, an African startup that is focused on AI for Africans by Africans. He is also the chief investigator on the Masakane NLP project, which aims to develop NLP technologies for African languages. He's also the co-founder of the Deep Learning Endeavor, the leading grassroots machine learning and artificial intelligence conference on the African continent that aims to empower and support African researchers and practitioners in the field. Welcome, Professor Vukosi. Our third panelist is Dr. Chijioke Okori from the Data Science Law Lab at the University of Pretoria, which is a research group that deploys research in law and produces independent and authoritative evidence and policy advice to support the growth of all aspects of data science research, development, and application across Africa. Before becoming a full-time researcher and policy consultant, she was a senior associate in the law firm of CLP Legal, Lagos, Nigeria. She's also the lead advisor at PenGuide Advisory, a firm that provides research, educational, legal, and regulatory advisory services in various fields, including copyright and emerging technologies. At PenGuide, she has the responsibility of leading research, training, and legal advisory services for a range of clients, including government and government agencies, companies and nonprofit organizations, entrepreneurs within Nigeria, across Africa, and internationally. Dr. Okori is Africa correspondent, she put it in quotation, one single quotation. And award-winning intellectual property law blog, the IP Cat, and an associate editor of the South African Intellectual Property Law Journal. You can find more information on her website if you're interested in the Law Lab. So welcome, Dr. Okori. The last part of my panel is Paul DeSantos, who is a data professional and a proud UP alumnus with over a decade of experience spanning the full AI value chain. He has worked across diverse industries, including manufacturing, social impact, health, and consulting, with a strong focus on delivering value from R&D initiatives. Okay, he's online. If you can see on that side, he looks exactly like his picture. Currently, Paul is working on multimodal foundation models tailored for the Nordic languages and AI Sweden. So very welcome to you, Paul, who's joining us online. Okay, so I'm going to hand over to my panelists, who are actually going to give a brief introduction to the topic for the day. I'm going to start with you, Namande.
Hi, everyone. So when we look at AI and low resource languages, specifically when we look at it in South Africa, I think it's an important discussion and an important area of development. So today, I think we are going to have a platform that helps us look at more into collaboration and looking at what are the challenges that that low resource languages or low resource development in AI get. Thank you.
So from my side, I spend a lot of time trying, even if my lab might say no, to get the technical parts right that we need in thinking about natural language processing and our languages across the African continent. It's not really only about large language models. I think the reason that we're thinking about that right now is just that, yes, there's a hype cycle. There are capabilities that people are able to access much faster now than before. And it feels like, you know, there has to be this rush for people to say, hey, let's build up more large language models for our languages specifically. But this is not necessarily, I think, the direction we have to take. There's still lots that we still have to learn when it comes to computational linguistics, from even basic natural language processing that comes to most of our languages. The African continent, just for context, for everybody here physically and online, we're at about 3,000 plus languages, right? Many, many are spoken, like it was spoken and not even written. Many are spoken by millions of people, but the availability of resources, especially these digital resources, are very small. So we need to think about how we go forward given this situation. So some of the reasons, like, you know, being on this panel is thinking about there's implications that are technical, there's implications that are societal. The earlier workshop we had, led by the Data Science Law Lab, here at the university also brought up thinking about how we expand access in multiple languages, because you have, for example, challenges with misinformation, engagement online, especially in things like content moderation in our languages, things that are important in safeguarding the quality of life of people on the continent and in the country as well. Lastly, I think, is to then think about what are the opportunities that people can come together on to really get most of this work done, right? Yes, on the African continent, we do not have the compute, but the amount of compute that you need to do the current direction that people are rushing into with bigger models is not something that we're going to have in the short to, like, you know, medium term. So you have to think very differently. The amount of data that we need also is still a lot that still needs to be done in that space, which probably then gets us to think about smaller models and smaller tasks that we really want to get very well. But ultimately, we also need to think about the capacity in the country of people working on research in these spaces. Yes, here on the panel, we'll be talking about natural language processing using AI, but there's wider AI skills that are required for us to really get to the point that we need. So yeah, I think that was my opening.
Okay. So for me, I think obviously coming from a law and from a legal perspective, what you don't want to see is laws serving as a restriction to innovation. You don't want a situation where you are applying laws in a way that does not suit the context for which it is being applied to. And that's something that is very particular for South Africa, but also for the wider African continent, because obviously of our shared colonial past, there's the tendency to, obviously we are coming from a perspective where there are laws that are inherited from outside Africa that needs to be updated. But even in updating it, where do we look to in terms of updating those laws? And so you want to look at the innovation that takes place on the continent, in the country, in South Africa, and look to ways in which law can serve as a tool for advancement of innovation. So how the law does this is as important as what it does. So it's beyond looking at the content of the law itself. It's also now looking at how does the law make sense for the lay person? How does the law make sense for the people who are working on the technical aspects of the issue? I will stop here. Yeah.
Paul,
we can do.
Sorry.
Yeah. Can you all hear me?
We can hear. Yeah. Please do a short intro.
Perfect. Yeah. So I think I'd like to intro maybe on two topics. One is just sort of, you know, why is AI Sweden in this conversation? What's going on here? So AI Sweden specifically has been working with language models for a very long time through this NLU group. As early as 2019, already using language models for Swedish authorities. The group sort of officially formed in the around 2021 at AI Sweden, but the sort of members had already been doing quite a lot of work there. And the first Scandinavian truly large language model was released very shortly after GPT-3 and before ChatGPT even. And a lot of the work over the last sort of 2 to 3 years has been about validating the use of these models in the sort of Scandinavian context. And we're seeing more and more this rise of open models and being able to address the needs of our sort of low resource language context. And more our group is actually evolving into being involved in European initiatives where we are helping guide and develop the processes for European language models that cover very, very diverse groups of languages. And finally, just to expand on a little bit of what Professor Fokozi was saying, I think, you know, talking about competence and they're not just in developing these language models, but all the stuff that goes into it, being able to work with high performance computing clusters, data, but not even just training data. How do we evaluate things robustly? Access to compute is obviously a big thing, but also getting the funding to be able to do that. I think one of the things that I've been sort of seeing a lot more is that there is some access to funding for research, but not necessarily for developing artifacts, which is a lot of what the industry maybe wants and is asking for right now. So I'm hoping we're going to be able to, you know, traverse this landscape within this discussion.
Thank you very much, Paul. So I'm going to pose some questions to our panel, after which I will then give over to the audience. So we are talking about low-resource languages, underrepresented languages, right? So what are the main challenges that you have faced or that we face when developing AI models for these kinds of languages, and how can we overcome them?
I'll speak on the work that I'm currently doing. As much as we speak about how data in low resource languages is, we lack data, we also lack the resources to actually compute, as Mokosi has said. I'll make an example in terms of medical text simplification. In medical text simplification, there are resources that can help you understand the relationships of medical domain or the entities. When you come to low resource languages, sometimes you have none of that. So that means you actually have to start from the engineering of that data, of that relationship. But the engineering also, because you are a computer scientist, also needs what medical doctors or medical facilities or people who can help you understand this. So then it becomes this multifaceted problem, because now it's not only medical doctors, you also need linguistics to actually check if the linguistics aspects are there. So I can say how you solve that problem is actually bringing everyone together, because it is a multidisciplinary problem that needs everyone's input in terms of building. Before we even build the AI models, we need to actually build the tools that can help us build accurate AI models. Thank you.
Thanks, Simone. I think building on that, if you've been to any of my recent talks, I highlight the thing that thinking about low resource language, AI or natural language processing, is you're dealing with an adaptive problem and not a technical problem. So I think what Nomura is trying to say is that there's a technical aspect of saying you can try it, get bigger data and then just pump in more compute and figure out what actually you can extract out of that. But the reality is that to increase the amount of data or to deal with the amount of compute or to deal with the questions about how data moves around, all of that is people, and more people. It is not about the technical aspect necessarily. So you end up having to be very multi or transdisciplinary, as we talk about here at the university. It's a big thing by default, as opposed to being something that you add on. So it shouldn't be lost on anybody who's here that we are at the library, and not another venue on the campus. I kept on going, we should really have a chair, because even at the university, we've had to start looking at how we connect across the university to look at languages, right? So library being one place, the building next door is a humanities building. You've got the African Languages Department. The other campus, you have Fundruf, where it's the education faculty. All of these, we've been starting to work more and more together, because to get the data or content, it means also solving other problems in other spaces as well. And it's not just saying, us as computer scientists just want the data. It's a play. If you do that, you completely break trust very quickly, and people think that you're not really, you don't really care about the problem at hand. That's one thing. So you need to do that, build that trust, and then build these shared goals that you have. So we're at the library because we've got projects that we're working on together to do with AI. One big pilot project right now is on looking at how far the current human versus machine translation can work to look at scientific abstracts in the university. So specifically, we're looking at PhD thesis and trying to make them more accessible to people by translating the titles and the abstracts and seeing how far that's going to go. I think we've gotten our first few samples in the last 2 weeks, and we'll be evaluating the samples, being they come from human translators, like translation specialists. And that then requires African languages. But then you also want to provide benchmarks and say the current tools that are out there for machine translation that are AI, this is how far they get. And we know they're going to not be accurate, but it's always good to tell people how inaccurate they are, because then they can start building and trying to fix those things. So that's a big part. I think this transdisciplinariness is going to be very important. The last one is that last week I was at a conference hosted by UP and Univen, and talking to people in health actually was very interesting, because we have another project that we're working on trying to record 3,000 hours of speech. It'll probably be one of the largest speech data sets, not just in South Africa, Africa, but the world. And one of the things is to identify health content. And we end up talking with nurses and nursing scholars about what actually happens in a clinic. And one of the things they highlighted was, all of our notes are written in English because that's what you share. But then every day when we're doing training at the clinics, it's all done in a local language. but it's not recorded or written down. Right? So to get to that point, we needed to get to that shared understanding of like, oh, wait, that as your artifact, if you can get it right, becomes something we can work on. But then at the same time, there should be things we give back to you as a community that allows you to do your work much better. Right? So finding these opportunities in different spaces is going to be very important. And then it means that what are the frameworks that allow us to actually be able to do that? So there will be things that are required inside the university, there will be things that are required by society and other spaces. And I'm hoping, yeah, as part of this discussion, we'll surface some of these things.
Since I don't develop language models, I think Paul should go first, then I will speak to some of the issues that I have.
Yeah, perfect. So really this question about, you know, the challenges we face, there's a few things. One of, apart from the ones that have already been discussed, I think one that's worth unpacking a bit more is around linguistic diversity. When things are written down, I mean, it's a really good way of us keeping record of stuff, right? But it's almost like a photocopy of the language. You miss so much detail from that, that's just lost from the way it's spoken or, you know, the visual cues that come with it. And one of the things that we are quite actively exploring is a lot of work in the audio domain, and figuring out how we can use that in this sort of low resource context to really capture the essence of these languages a little bit better. Another big thing for us specifically is, you know, data scarcity is a thing for the low resource languages, but you also don't need to have this big hammer approach. We have one model that can just do absolutely everything. It forces you to think in very targeted and specific ways to produce models that are task specific and can solve real problems in the real world. And for that, you can, you know, narrow your scope and work with the data resources and technical resources that you have to build something that's actually properly useful for businesses and society.
Thank you very much, Paul. So I think maybe from a legal perspective, you can offer some insights.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. Because obviously I said I don't develop AI models for any language, low resource, high resource, mid resource, whatever. But one of the things that come out from what Mamata have said, because you have said and Paul have said as well, you here at UP, we talk about and we do transdisciplinary research where it's not, you know, like because you said, it's not something that you add on when, you know, midway into your work or midway into a specific project, you remember that, oh, I can't actually do this by myself, but it's something that goes into the design of the research that you do of the project that you embark on. But looking at it from like a legal perspective, one huge thing is always legal compliance. Like if you're working on issues that border on copyright law, for example, or other intellectual property laws, how do you comply? Obviously, when you're dealing with, even internally within South Africa, you're dealing with local partners or you're dealing with international partners, they want to be comfortable in collaborating with you because they don't want to incur legal liability because of the way that you are carrying on with your project. So within that transdisciplinary approach to designing the project, there's obviously the presence of legal because you want to ensure that you're complying with laws. But looking at that inwards from as a legal research perspective, you want to not, you want to break things down. You want to break the laws down in a way that is easy for anyone to understand, for anyone to apply, for anyone to grapple with, to deal with. When you talk about law as a context-based document or as something that guides or regulates behavior, you want to be dealing with the specific context that you're dealing with, that you are faced with. So when you are looking to audio, for example, as a solution to dealing with context or linguistic diversity that you want to guess that might not be present in text-based materials, you're thinking, for example, of privacy and data protection laws, because you also don't want to run foul of those laws because they speak to issues around ethics, it speaks to issues around bias, and so on and so forth. And so from our side, it's also about making the law accessible. What kind of artifacts are you creating from existing statutes, existing policy documents that allow people to guide behavior, that make it easy for people to comply? The best thing you want, or the most advantageous thing that could happen, is for people to feel comfortable in complying with laws, in engaging with policy, because it makes sense to them, because it helps them rather than restrict them or constrict them in the way that they want to innovate.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you brought up that point about bias, because that's going to be my next question. So thank you very much for your insights to the question that I posed to you. And, you know, Bugosi, you said it's more an adaptive problem. It's not a technical problem. And building on that, Paul, you mentioned that it's important to build trust, right? To produce models that are task-specific, not generic. So my next question then is, how can local communities and stakeholders contribute to the development of these AI models? And also, how do we make sure that they are culturally appropriate and free from bias?
Okay, I'll try and then we'll switch the mic. this is a very important piece. I think going back to Paul's comment that thinking about like one model to rule them all is a problem, because what tends to happen is that what's inside those models are not necessarily the things that represents the communities out there the best. A question I've been having fun asking for the last year is, are we sure that South Africans or communities within the African continent want chatbots? Is that the best interface to communities? And it's not necessarily like a given, right? You actually have to go out and identify what actually the problem, like, you know, how you can use natural language processing to assist them. And it might come back that it's not chatbots. But at the moment, because that's the kind of zeitgeist, that's the thing that everybody's trying to offer, right? And say chatbots will solve everything. But if you work in that area in terms of technical, you start going like, this is really the best way to do this. It seems it might just be easier for me to just walk over and just, you know, answer the person's question, as opposed to trying to resolve this via a chatbot. So those are like why it's important to reduce that bias. The other one I want to highlight that actually nicely dovetailed yesterday has been these conversations about where a lot of language data, especially in developing countries, comes from. A lot of it ends up coming from religious sources. Why? It's because of, yes, our history with colonialism, that the first people who might have written down a language or interacted were missionaries coming into a country. And it's not that necessarily that they've written the language correctly, which is another thing that people should understand, or recorded correctly. It was just, what can we do minimum so that we can either translate a religious text or get people to be converted? And that's a very different goal than, hey, let's record a language, like, you know, for posterity. So if you think about, for example, Sesotho is a very tonal language. So the way you say a word changes its meaning. But Sesotho today in 2024 does not have diacritics. So the way it's written already is wrong. Right? Because a person who grew up with Sesotho knows that you can have a word written the same way, but the way you pronounce it changes its meaning. And as such, that meaning is supposed to be carried in the way, as a diacritics are those little squigglies and hats that you see on the words, just for context, right? The other one, though, is that you're caught up in this catch-22 situation. So yesterday, the Bapulana community in Mpumalanga and Limpopo were celebrating a milestone of translating the Bible into Sipula. Right. And for that community, it's been very important, right? Because it connects to their matters of faith and their matters of representation. But then now bias comes in, right? Because now going into the future, the most likely easily accessible text in the near future in Sipulana, which is actually a language, it might not be one of the official languages of the country, is going to be religious-based, and then people might start using that and say, let's build tools on top of it. But that is not necessarily representative of general community of Bapulan. And these are the things we have to deal with all the time. And that's why you have to think about how you let people participate in these processes, in thinking and defining what is it for themselves that they want. And maybe for Bapulana at this moment in time, it is, hey, we would like to worship in the way we would like to, and we would like tools that assist us in getting better at that. But this might be different from somebody who speaks Sepedi, right? And then somebody who speaks Kuluvedi. All of these are all, you know, things that we need to bubble up. It's not technology just for technology's sake, but we want it to be something that serves people.
Thank you. I think you took a lot of the points that I wanted to say. The main thing that I think should be, like you said, looking at how can we co-design with our community instead of us bringing a solution to a community, how can we build with the community so that we are able to have to build the language models that have the same values that that the community needs. And another thing is that in terms of local communities, advocacy of languages shows that the more we advocate for languages, the more the data set grows. And what I mean in terms of advocacy is, I mean that for where we are, wherever you are in business or in our local communities, if it means tweeting in your language, that is you advocating for your language. If it means that you have business letters that you need to send to people, you can send them in those low resource languages. That helps build a language that is probably going extinct. And that language then becomes visible, and that in turn helps the next generation of developers to develop on that language. For instance, when I was doing my research in medical health, I realized in low resource medical health, I realized that there is a difference in policies between provinces. If we look at KZN, for instance, they actually do advocate for Zulu. In all of their communication, you'll find that they do newsletters, which is very important because then we have that data set. And then when I look at other provinces, I find that there isn't that much advocacy. So that's why I think that advocating for our languages in all of these platforms will help us bridge that gap, at least when we start. Thank you.
Any other additions to this question, Paul?
Yeah, I'd like to add a few things, because this question is one of my favorite sort of topics. the first thing, like, no data set is ever going to be free from bias. Like, it's just inherent to how data is collected, processed, labeled. There's always some kind of bias. So I think we need to be like flipping this narrative to be making sure that our data sets have the appropriate kind of bias that is culturally relevant, that's properly diverse and contextual to the reality of the people that speak that language. And I think that's just a really important distinction to make. I think in terms of communities and the cultural relevance, I'd really love to see in the language space an open street map kind of moment. My background is in spatial analytics, geographic information science, and OpenStreetMap is this really amazing community initiative where it's crowdsourced data. People have literally built an entire map of the world, and I'd really love for us to get to a point where we have like the maturity and understanding of what it takes to properly document a language and to capture it with communities in this sort of reference across the globe. I think more of these sort of community initiatives where people who care about this stuff can actively build these data sets in a very mindful and tailored way is going to have a huge impact.
Thank you very much, Paul. Do you have anything to add? Did you okay?
At the end of the day, I like what Paul said about the right kind of bias, because even like within the university, for example, I would always have, you know, bias for legal, for law, for like policy. That's how I approach problems. I look at them like thinking about what law regulates this, what law should guide how we do things. But even law itself has its own bias, depending on who is making it, who it is being made for, and what is considered important at any given point in time. And so we then could then use law and policies as a way to ensure that we have the right kind of bias speaking, that we have bias that speaks to the context, the issues of the people that we are dealing with. Obviously, depending on the sector, different considerations would apply. And when it comes to African languages, especially, there's also issues around like respect for the people, respect for their contribution, respect for their personhood. And some of those things are things that bother more on ethics and more on codes of behavior than even what that you know beyond what law can tell us or how law would tell us how to behave in that kind of spaces.
That is very insightful. Vukosi, what role do you envision universities and academic institutions such as the one we're sitting in right now play in ensuring that the development of AI for low resource languages remains sustainable but also is inclusive?
I think one has been the part of situating a university when it comes to language itself within the full societal structure of how language development is going to happen. So for us in South Africa, as you go back to what, like 1993, when our first laws in this area started coming in or saying, this is how we're going to develop languages. And there have been attempts at righting some of the wrongs of the past, but then also doing development. And a lot of them come down to what resources do we have? The thing that's been interesting is that if you start digging up a lot of government spending in South Africa that's been very disconnected. So it's very disparate. So it might be Department of Higher Education, it might be Department of Science and Innovation, it might be Department of Sports Arts and Culture. There have been lots of investments into trying to create language resources. It's just that they don't come together in a way that really allows to make the big impact. And I think the universities stand a very like in a good place to be on one place. It's almost like a neutral space, right? You're building towards knowledge and you're building. But at the same time, they've also been part of these projects. So some of the things that we've been doing, we're working on it a lot. We're just updating with some of our research assistants this morning. We've identified that from the Department of Sports, Arts and Culture, Department of Higher Education, Department of Science and Innovation, they had made these investments and gotten people to create glossaries, terminology lists, translations in the past, but these are scattered across the country. So one of the things we're doing this year is to bring, for example, the terminology lists and glossaries into one space. So we're hoping by the end of October to launch a new service that has four words for their definitions translated from as many of these as possible in one space, because it gets us to be able to look at it. And I know for the linguists, sometimes there's also this question of, but who defined what? It becomes a big question if you work with linguists. And for us in some spaces that we have to start somewhere. So first let's share what's being created for the public good, and then get into the debate of is the definition correct? Because then at least people have somewhere to start with and build. Because that project I talked about that we're trying to do translations of our abstracts throughout the university, right? As just a sample of them. We will come to those problems that you look at a term, and the human translation professional will also have a problem translating. And if they do, the machine is probably going to be completely off. All right. And now you want to provide a resource that's nicely, easily available for people to use across the country, where they can go check, see who created it. Was it University of Pretoria who created the original term list, or was it Stellenbosch, or was it UNISA, or was it UJ? So they can go back and then identify and say, oh, we want to ask them how you came up with this. That's what we want. It spurs on, as you said, sometimes these artifacts that come from one place are actually useful in another place as well. So it's not just the AI that's important, but it's going to generate like a major conversation. And that this is just an example of like one of the things that we can do. The others, as I said, like we're doing this big project with the Gates Foundation, a couple of partners, and Meta of collecting about 3,000 hours of speech. It is like, you know, in terms of how we think innovatively, it's breaking our heads, because you need to think how you're going to get be able to collect, you know, 500 hours of a language, 60% of that being either between agriculture and health. And it not necessarily, ultimately, you don't want it to be a translation. You want, how do people who speak isiZulu normally speak about health, right? Not translated from English or another language, because it removes the context if you do that, right? So these are questions that then come up. Again, universities are great places to think about these things, because then you can bring in all these different people and say, hey, let's look at this problem and let's, like, you know, what do we do? And ultimately, we must also live in a living lab. How then does this all feed back into even the policies of the university itself going into the future?
Thank you very much. Nomonde, you spoke briefly about what your research is about. So what are some of the practical applications of your research, and how do you envision that these applications can be scaled across the African continent, the globe at large? Let's repeat.
So I think practical applications, we look at applications that can help us or help lay readers get information. And that is the point I'm trying to make in terms of my research, especially for medical information. And how we can do that is look at digital platforms that can use AI in terms of translating or simplifying. But as Lucas has said, sometimes when you do low resource languages in terms of translation, you kind of lose from English to this low resource languages, you kind of lose the nuisance of the African languages. So building platforms or building AIs that can bridge that information gap, and also build, and it also kind of doesn't only rely on the AI. It also relies on how are we going to evaluate all of this information that we have generated. So gathering all of that, I think my research wants to look at the applications that can help us generate that information and give it to different stakeholders. And I think that can translate to many languages in many African countries, because we can then use some AI models to leverage the languages that we've already built. So if the languages that I've already built in South Africa can be leveraged in another country in this specific type of problem. So I think in general, looking at readability is a very difficult task on its own. So it needs to merge in different languages across Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Paul, I'm going to pose a question to you. What innovations in NLP could be essential in developing AI for low resource languages? And what do you envision some of the future breakthroughs would be?
Yeah, sure. So I'll speak first just a little bit about like how people are trying to tackle it today. The main sort of way of handling it is through transfer learning. So you have some model that's trained on a huge corpora of a high resource language, And then you fine tune it to the language that you want your task to be in. And this sort of process of first training on a very large data set and then fine tuning it on a small one is actually quite data efficient for the low resource language. But you get funny things that still happen that you have to be really mindful of. I'll give one example. We've recently done a fine tune of Llama 3 to Swedish. And one of our test cases is we ask it to generate a recipe of a pancake. So it gives you this really great recipe to make a pancake. All the steps are there, the ingredients, everything is right. But all the measurements in Sweden, it's very common to see deciliters as a measurement for liquids and stuff in recipes. But all the measurements are in like American units. So even though it's got the translation rights, it's kind of got the cultural context a little bit wrong. So through these sort of transfer learning exercises, we need to make sure that the actual data being used in that transfer process is well adapted for the downstream task that you want to be using it for. The other two main things that are sort of happening a lot today is data augmentation in various ways. So back translations or having parallel corpora. Or even there's a technique being used quite a lot now where you take some data in a certain format and you sort of change it into a more textbook looking format. So you restructure it that it's got a nice introduction, a middle and an end with a question about what's going on in that data to actually help steer the model's understanding. And then sort of finally, what's happening in the space currently is we're getting longer context windows. So you can have a model look at a lot more text all at once. And this opens up in context learning, where you could have a model that's not trained on a language at all, but if you can sort of engineer your prompt really well with good examples and the information that it needs, you can actually make it the model do your task in a very generalizable sort of manner. There's a lot of sort of future breakthroughs, I think, that are coming. I do think we're going to start seeing more and more of models that are sort of language agnostic, trained on many, many languages. And the objective isn't necessarily to be fluent in any one specific model, but to have really solid representations in the latent space of the concepts that are being described by those languages. And I think more and more we'll also be seeing these sort of pivot-based translations. So for example, instead of trying to go straight from English to Faroese, which language spoken on the Faroe Islands, you may first go to Swedish and then to that language because they have a similar sort of North Germanic root. But all of this is going to be really, really about how we are collaborating and forming these data sets that are fit for purpose.
Thank you very much, Paul. And then for Shijioke, I have another question for you. So from a legal perspective, you are our expert now. What are some of the implications of data licensing on developing AI language models that require large data sets? And also to do with that, if we look at the South African perspective or context, right, we have POPIA. So how would that sort of impede or assist, you know, in terms of data licensing?
Okay, so when you talk about data licensing, it's a license proceeds from either a place of ownership or possession, but also maybe a place of authority. So when you talk about licensing that proceeds from a place of possession or ownership, you're talking about like, let's say someone has copyright over the data sets that they've created or they've produced, or that someone is exercising maybe contractual rights where they are saying, you may or may not do this with this data set, which I am making available to you. If you have something that, a license that proceeds from a place of authority, think about maybe a liquor license that the government gives you because it's the government that allows you to sell liquor in a particular place, or your driver's license that allows you to drive on South African roads, for example. So when you look at data licensing from that perspective, you're thinking about, A, maybe the license comes from a place of, what you're thinking about, people like Bukosi, like Nomande, who are creating, like Paul, who are creating data sets, who are deploying data sets and using them to train AI models and things like that. And you're thinking about how should they be making those data sets available? Because obviously, if they take the approach of a much restrictive custodial approach to the data set, we would not have a lot of innovation happening. So there's that, which leads us to thinking about you using open licenses where you are sharing openly with the community and collaborating with other people, adding on, removing, and things like that. And there are considerations around that. But also when you don't want to now take that kind of private to public sharing approach to when you have the data set in the hands of public institutions or public agencies, because they should not ideally be licensing the data that they generate by virtue of the fact that they are performing a public duty. You want them to take a more open approach to sharing than using licenses as a tool with which they share the data set. So for example, in the EU, you have the Open Data Directive that sort of like basically mandates governments to practice openness in the way that they share documents, they share whatever data that they generate from performing their public duty. When you talk about the PUPI Act, which is the Protection of Personal Information Act in South Africa, dealing with privacy rights, data protection, and all that, the statutory requirements differ slightly from when you're talking about like purely a copyright issue, because the law does not necessarily prohibit you from processing or collecting personal information or personal data, but it imposes restrictions and obligations on you in how you collect. So one key thing is usually consent. So when you want to collect or when you are going to process personal data or personal information, you're supposed to have prior consent, not consent as an afterthought. And so you are speaking to people, you're saying, this is why I am collecting, this is what I will do with it. And if the purpose for which you are collecting and which you disclose at the point of collection, if it changes, you're supposed to go back and obtain consent for the new uses or new purposes that you want to apply the data collected to. So that is not would not ideally be a situation where you are talking more like a licensing thing, because in that space, you're dealing more with consent, you're dealing more with trying to make sure that you comply with the statutory requirements that allow you to legally and validly process those kinds of data in those kinds of spaces. What are the implications of data licensing in that space? It's just for us to think about the source of the data set in each case. The source would be our first guiding point or something that guides us in terms of how we operate in that space.
Thank you very much. That was very insightful. So just to follow up on that, and it's not just directed at you, I'm going to pose it as a general question, because I think this one is not just from a practitioner point of view, but also from a development point of view. So you spoke about licenses, you spoke about open licenses, right? But there's another spectrum or other part of that, which is commercialization. So in terms of what we are speaking about in terms of sustainability, accessibility, inclusivity of these low resource models that we are trying to build is, how do we balance this? If you're a developer, you are trying to gain some profit, by licensing your data. And also for those people that need access to that data, but it's not openly accessible to them. How do we balance that?
This one is a very exciting question for me because we started thinking about this exact thing in terms of how do you balance commercialization with openness. And the primary thing that we've seen, you know, from the research that we've had in this space is that we should not be looking at openness as something that precludes us getting a benefit. And I say benefits because every commercializable exchange does not have to be only money. Vukosi mentioned, and I think Amanda mentioned as well, and Paul as well, the issue of access to compute, which is a huge thing for here in South Africa and the wider African continent. So you could have a situation where you're not asking for royalties, you're not asking for payments of money, but you're asking for access to compute, where you are allowed to actually train models and build AI models and AI products on the basis of data sets that you have created, that you've leveled, that you've produced, and all that. So that's one key way of looking at it. Recently, in collaboration with Vukosi's lab, we came up with a new open data license called the Mulito Obodo Open Data License. So Mulito Obodo is from my language. I took that liberty because I drafted the license with other colleagues. So I said, why not advocate for my language? See? So Mulito Obodo is Igbo. It means like raising the community, building the community. So if you put it in Google Translate, it will say community development, but it's deeper than that. But what we are saying with that license is that it's possible to have an exchange for data sets that we create on this continent. It is possible to have an exchange that is not based on money, but gives us value, the actual value that we want. So sometimes it might be money. Sometimes it might be that we want you to have access to these data sets, but we want you to share whatever you generate from it in the same way that you received the data set. Sometimes it might be that we're asking for access to compute. Sometimes it might be that we're asking for us to collaborate with you to build in something, you know, out of that. What we want to avoid is a situation where, which is something that has, you know, happened too many times, is a situation where you openly license these data sets. People from wherever in the world take these data sets because they have access to, you know, more infrastructure than you could maybe possibly dream of having. They would create products that they then come back and sell to you, which is inequitable. Like it's not sustainable for us to continue in that practice. So how do we practice openness in a way that is equitable, in a way that responds to our context? It's very key. It's very important.
Thank you very much. Any other views on this?
Connected to your other question about what we can do as a university, I think this one, I've never talked to Chioka about this one. The library should think about seeing how we can start incorporating these licenses that we're developing here at the university into also what we do in thinking through those processes, because I think it's also part of getting feedback, right, in one space, and then maybe with also the AI Sweden and the Swedish government and thinking about wider across the country or the continent, how do we keep these conversations about equitable licensing going on? Because it's not a one-size-fits-all. You need to, again, understand what communities need. But for a lot of us, the reason we've come to thinking about licensing as just one of the pillars, I sit, for example, on the Lacuna Fund and on the steering committee for that. The Lacuna Fund funds the creation of data sets, especially from developing countries that can be used for AI. So language is one. We funded things in agriculture and computer vision, in climate. I have no concept of time anymore. I think it's 2 weeks ago we were in New York. And there was the grantees who got the climate funding to create were all gathering there. But some of the feedback that we got from grantees from the past, we've been running something 2022, was this challenge that Lacuna Fund only funds the creation of the data sets. But then as soon as the data sets become available and they're required to be on an open license, as soon as that data set becomes available, somebody else is building the model, somebody else is getting kind of a huge benefit, and they're not necessarily, as I said, giving back into the communities in the way that we'd expect, right? The reason that we're funding this creation is to get so that people are more represented and innovators also come in. But then we do want to then have that other part of the conversation on how do you interact with the communities that ultimately created these resources that become available to AI. So it's not coming from like nowhere. It has been a part of a lot of grassroots organizations on the African continent, South America, been working over the last 5 years or so. And now the next part of the equation that needs to be resolved is how you make those organizations more sustainable. It can't be that people are just always volunteering their time for free. And then on the other side, somebody else is figuring out that, oh, I can actually use this resource and just keep on increasing my competitive advantage in a commercial manner. Something has to come in. And part of that is thinking about licensing. Other parts is events like this where people get to learn, understand, and then they can also change the way that they make decisions in the places that they're from. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Paul Namande, do you have anything that you want to add?
Just a small addition. I think this discussion in terms of licensing also involves in terms of when you're doing your PhD, you realize that sometimes you want to hold on to your data set and not send it to the public so that you at least do your work, because there's no leverage in terms of sending your data set and you realize that you don't actually get acknowledged. So you'd rather just keep it, and then other PhD students can't build on your work, right? So I think looking at discussion of licensing is a very important one.
Yeah, the only thing that I'll add, so some of our models they're open, they're released, but they don't have extremely permissive licenses in the sense that people can do stuff with it, but the commercial T's and C's attached to it seem in some ways to potentially be putting people off actually using that stuff. So I think this is it's definitely not a solved problem, and it's going to be a space that gets a lot more attention now that even the EU AI Act has come into effect, and more sort of eyes are being put on the data and where it's come from, how was it ethically sourced, and so on. But I think it's something that the whole community is going to have to be like grappling with for quite a while still.
Thank you very much, Paul. I think we've been talking amongst ourselves, and I see people need to stretch. So if you need to stand up and stretch before we give it over to you as the audience, if they have any questions. So just stand up and stretch, because we've been sitting for a long time now.